Hey, HG 101 fans, I want you to know that we're crowdfunding a brand new, gorgeously printed hardcover book covering 101 weird, obscure, historically important, and just plain cool Japanese video games. It's going to be called Hardcore Gaming 101 Presents Japanese Video Game Obscurities, but we can only put it out with your pledge. So check out hardcoregaming101.net. The link should be pretty much close to the top of the page. Japanese Video Game Obscurities. This is, if we get to do this, it's going to be our best looking book yet, and it's one of those books that it'll be about stuff you've probably never heard of. In fact, I can almost guarantee you won't have heard of almost all of it. So give a hoot, fund our book, $15 for the PDF, $20 plus shipping for the hardcover. Do it!
Hello and welcome to episode 76 of HardcoreGaming101.net's Top 47,858 Games of All Time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games you nominate. My name is Carl, and I am the Doodle King, a tool created for a single purpose. Well, that's really filthy, but okay. My panelists today are
the Gunhort,
and we're also joined by two special guests. One of them is our special guest in that he is our editor and has been on the show a couple of times already, Jeff Rude.
Hi, I'm Jeff.
And you're the Electric Viking. Have you lost that one now, or are you still?
I'm the Electric Viking on some networks and Awesome Van Art on others.
And we also have a guest who is really special and has been invited on the show by Jeff, and he does some great work, and that is Gino, that Pinguino, Grieco.
You nailed it.
Thank you.
You nailed it.
I've been
it.
Reading that over and over in my head, trying so hard to get that name right. I'm glad to hear I got it.
Thank you very much. I'd like you to know that I am also the Doodle King, and we're going to have to rumble to find out which one of us is the real one.
You know what happens when two Doodle Kings rumble? You film it and you make some, make some money.
I know what happens when you fight like 5 to 7 Doodle Kings, one after another after another. It's not great.
But you make a lot of magical pen gel. I'll tell you that.
That's fair. That's true. That's true. And
yeah,
everything I draw is a monster. So that's great. I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to talk about Magic Pen Gel and Brave Fencer Musashi, two games that I remembered fondly from my childhood, rediscovered as an adult, and realized I was an idiot as a child. But I'm going to have a great time. This is going to be great.
And just before we step off, what would our listeners have maybe heard from you from? Or
sure. You might know of me from the Giant Bomb Community Endurance Run that I helped organize for the last few years. I took the torch from Jeff a couple of years ago because I believe you had some personal issues you needed to take care of, some commitments, and you couldn't organize one of them. And I was like, this is too cool of a thing to let die. Let's do this. And we've been carrying it on.
I have a great respect and appreciation for you stepping up and making that much bigger than I probably ever was going to. It's been really great watching that.
It's been a great experience. It just keeps on chugging. You might know me from my podcast, Deep Listens, which is a gaming book club, bi-weekly gaming book club. It's an every week podcast, but we only play a new game every 2 weeks because it's hard to play a game a week. We have a lot of people.
Our old version of our show, we did a game every month, and we were like, this is way too hard. Forget this. So we made a show where we kind of play a bunch of games every so often. It's a real challenge to play a game properly in like a week or two. So that's great. And we will put links to your stuff somewhere in our description, so everyone can click through to that. That'd be great.
You might also know me from GiantBomb.com. I was a freelancer. I was one of their Giant Bomb contributors for a bit. So
it's pretty cool. Real Giant Bomb.
Till they Austin Walker decide to head over to Wave of York and do his own thing.
Yeah,
I guess
and started Waypoint. If you any of the Final Fantasy IX coverage that snuck onto that site, I pretty much snuck it there.
On this podcast, we have three rules. Rule number one: all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule number two: you can nominate one game via a 5-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. We've stopped accepting nominations via Twitter for the foreseeable future. Rule number three: you can nominate games that have already been nominated, but don't nominate games we've already ranked. You can see the master list for yourself. Check out bit.ly/47kgames. Our next game is Brave Fencer Musashi. It was nominated to us by @ggjofus. It was developed by Square and published by Square in Japan and Square Electronic Arts in the US So was that actually Electronic Arts, like publishing Foursquare, I think it was. Is that the division?
Let me take a look.
Because, yeah, I think I remember that they had a deal with them.
Yes, it was a joint venture between Squaresoft and Electronic Arts. So Squaresoft published in North America and Electric Arts. Okay, Square helped publish EA games in Asia, and then EA helped publish Square games in the US.
That's a really cool bit of trivia that we can that you can all know now that that happened. Because that doesn't happen anymore. I think Square does their own stuff, and they're with Eidos or whatever. Eidos. I got it. I got there.
I think they actually nowadays publish Activision's games in Japan, don't they?
Yeah, I think I remember COD being published by them. So that's cool. But we're talking about Brave Fencer Musashi, and it was released on the PlayStation, which is completely unsurprising because it's a Squaresoft game, from 1998. And it was released on July 16th in Japan, apparently.
Yeah, so an important thing about Brave Fencer Musashi that I feel, before we even talk about the game, is that it came with a Final Fantasy VIII demo disc. And so I feel a lot of kids around that age came into contact with the game purely by happenstance because they wanted the demo disc. It was like the Crackdown of its time.
I was going to say, so it's the Zone of Enders strategy with Metal Gear Solid 2. Famously, that was actually a really good deal, by the way. I love Zone of the Enders, and getting an extra Metal Gear Solid 2 was actually a pretty solid deal. I don't think this game needed extra fluff. It's a pretty lengthy game. I would say I'd put it about, 18, 20 hours, so not bad.
I'd be in 15 hours myself.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. I mean, there's a handful of side stuff because it's a Square RPG, so I'm trying to work out how much you would actually get out of it. But so it came with Final Fantasy VIII everywhere? Is that right?
It came with a demo disc, of VIII. So basically they put together, I don't know, if you've played VIII, like the first mission where you're freeing Dale, it's the first seed mission.
Tonally different to most of the rest of the game, and one of the cooler parts of the game, I think, is that whole...
It also featured a completely different musical track that was changed for the final release for sounding too much like the theme from that Michael Bay film, The Rock.
Huh.
Yes.
I wonder if it was the same demo that was included. I had a Pizza Hut demo disc for the PlayStation that was that opening level of Final Fantasy VIII, and I'm wondering if they just sliced that same demo onto that disc.
Sliced? For Pizza Hut?
Kill me.
So, what about the game itself?
Yes.
You play as an agitated, small ninja samurai-like man who runs around a series of environments in a sort of action platformer style until you get bored, I guess, because that's the game. I mean, does someone want to actually take a good stab at describing the game?
Okay, so... Brave Fencer Musashi is basically like the PlayStation version of one of Square's action RPG titles like Secret of Mana or Secret of Evermore, except now fully polygonal, which was a first for Squaresoft, as only the fighting games had been done in full 3D, the RPGs taking the Resident Evil approach of polygons against 2D backdrops. It was also notable for its time for being the first Squaresoft game to feature extensive voice acting.
And they carried that over to the US, which I think was obviously a different set of people voicing it. I assume the Japanese version was in Japanese.
Yes. They are called it's clearly a Bora restaurant. I don't think it's the same voice acting.
Oh, what, you're saying that the guy didn't get super high on caffeine from the soda pop and pass out? Are you suggesting that didn't happen? That was just amusing when that happened. Also, because the bar is staffed by a what I would basically describe as a hostess or prostitute escort type woman. Like, she is pretty in your face about her job, I guess, because she basically hits on Musashi, which is really weird. I don't like that at all because he's 12 or something.
Yeah, there's a few different things going on here. One, Miyamoto Musashi was actually a samurai, a historic Japanese samurai of legend. He was one of the most legendary of all Japanese samurai. And they've taken him and made him a small child in the All-You-Can-Eat Kingdom. And I can't emphasize this enough. Every single character in the US version of this game is some sort of wildly either offensive or caricatured stereotype, and that's all they are in terms of their voice.
I feel every like single the only one, of them. One that's really missing is an extremely like racist Asian voice, because there's not that, but yes. Yeah, you've got...
But
you've
then got, the like, only two Asians in the game are Musashi and Kojiro.
Well, no, the what's name? I would say that definitely the store owner who appraises your items is supposed to be a stereotype Chinese merchant from sort of that they put in a lot of Japanese games, which is not culturally super great, but it shows yes. up a lot.
But it is amazing.
Yeah.
When you get summoned, when he gets summoned via the Binchotite and gets summoned by Princess Fillet, who's a valley girl who sounds like Alicia Silverstone and Clueless, I just was not prepared the first time I played
serious?
This game. Yeah. Choke me, gag me with a spoon.
Yeah. No, like that's amazing that that's exactly what happened.
When Scribe Shanky is just the most offensive gay stereotype I've seen in a good long while. And he starts hitting on this child. I'm just like, this game is of a time.
Yeah, give us some time to get settled before we, you know, get into this. I like the name Scribe Shanky, though. I like the names in this game. A lot of the
yes.
a lot of the writing and text that's not kind of the major stuff is actually kind of funny. Like, not like, just like, oh, yeah, that's a joke. I will smile wryly. It's a sensible chuckle of humor when some of the things, like the way that the... I can't remember the appraiser's name, but he, all of the things that he appraises, everything that's really good, he describes as complete garbage and then says it's a really great item. And anything that's like complete garbage, he'll be like, oh, that's a super rare, amazing coin. It's some token that's valueless in this country. It's like, what? There's like some subtle humor in there, which I like, but the writing is way too loud and in your face when it's the, it goes for the main character as well, who, I don't want to be the character of Musashi. I don't. He's like the annoying brat. He's like a scrappy character, except you have to play as him. Like, it's not yeah. well put together in that regard. I don't want to be Musashi.
Yeah, it's like someone watched Naruto and said, this kid is too subtle.
Is this because it predates Naruto by, I think, like 2 or 3 years?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's this game is in front of a few things there. But it is like the sassy child character, and... it alludes to the fact that I think this game is actually more of a kid's game than even like Square's regular RPG output, which I think is kind of shooting at sort of the middle teens area, maybe. Whereas I think this game is actually aged a little bit lower, given the kind of barebone nature of the plot, which is very basic. And the
I want to go there front. One thing that really bugs me is the fact that the whole bit about rescuing Princess Fillet takes up the entirety of the storyline, but at the same time, it's also really far in the background, too.
Right, because the start of this game is pretty good. I don't mean when you're introduced, because I was cringing the whole time during that. Like, also, one character that speaks with thighs and thouths. Was
Stuart Ribson. You don't say one bad thing about Stuart Ribson and his beholdeth brave friendsereth Musashi.
Don't you dare. I will continue to do it. I cringed the whole time. Every time he said anything, I was like, someone get Ted Woolsey on the line because he needs to fix this. but you know, like it's after you get through that, you know, once you get through that and the game throws a lot of like, you need to do this and this and this, and you're like, whoa, hold on. I have no idea what's going on at all. You go through actually pretty cool prologue. It's a linear set piece of stuff, and you get quite a few of the mechanics thrown at you, but you run down areas and you kill enemies and you steal their powers, which is something that Musashi can do for no adequately sort of reason.
It's mentioned that it's the power of a sword you're given.
Yes, no, I know that it's because of the power of the sword, but it's just weird. You like stab people with a sword and then you steal a power from them and then they fade out of existence, and it's this whole gameplay first.
Soul.
Yeah, you're the Soul Reaver, I think, in this one, actually. But yeah, that's a cool sequence. I really like it. And then
even the end of this really neat little set piece, so where you have to one foot and do pretty much the Indiana Jones boulder one from a giant stone head.
Right.
Except you run down the side of a building.
Yeah. I actually think there's this one bit of visual humor I love is when it seems to crash down at the side of the tower. Musashi does his little victory dance, then the eyes start glowing and it continues to roar after him.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can see that there's lots of heart in the right place and things, but then the game just immediately dumps you in, like, a town and a village, and you have tons of options that don't do very much and don't necessarily do very much for a while, and you're just sort of like, you gotta talk to the people in the town, but it's kind of hard to talk to them because you actually have to knock on some of their doors, and then you realize that there's a day-night system, which doesn't really do all that much. This is
That's actually probably one of my least favorite parts of the game overall, is that it has this weird life sim aspect that doesn't really do anything for the gameplay. You have to make sure Musashi is well rested, you have to deal with the night cycles, the shops are closed on certain days of the week, and I'm just like, why is this even there? It does nothing for the game.
It lacks the charm of something like Deadly Premonition, where like the game itself was barely a game, but it was kind of like poking the clockwork mechanism of this weird little town was
I think
most of the reason you showed up.
There's a whole bunch of things that are really affected in Deadly Premonition by the day-night cycle and the, the life elements, but here it's just like there's only enough for it to be annoying.
I think it's especially annoying because obviously your character, if it was just the day-night cycle, I think it would be, you know, I could be like, yeah, all right, it's cute that I have to wait until the night to talk to the crazy old man because, okay, he's crazy and refuses to answer his door outside of like 11 p.m. at night. And that, you know, that's kind of cute. And I liked the bit where you have to stalk out the Vampires to find out where they're coming from. I thought that was like, that's a nice use of this sort of thing. But then Musashi's like, if I don't get sleep every, like, 3 in-game days, I will walk really slow until you press the sleep button for, like, 30 real-life seconds where you just sort of stare at the screen while Musashi sleeps on the floor. And yes, you can go to the hotel, but it costs money, and that's not ideal because you also have to go to the hotel. And if you're in the middle of a dungeon and you're like, okay, Musashi's tired.
You bought the hotel, and that's also one of those little quality of life issues I have with the game, is the fact that you also have a room at the palace, which is free. But you can't. It will restore your health to full, your BP to full, and remove all tiredness. But for some reason, you can't save there. You have to go to the inn to save.
The inn is the only place you can save in the game, which bothers the hell out of me, because in the dungeons, there are little boxes, and they're really clever, because they'll
Oh, you mean the memory boxes?
Yeah, the memory boxes, which look like regular Chesa chests, and I think that was really lame that they aren't fancy-looking memory boxes. But you can't save in them. They save your game in the sense that if you die, you'll respawn in that spot instead of back at the last save point, which is nice, and I appreciate that that's even an option. But it's crazy that I'm like, why can I not just save in this box? And I had that problem when I was doing the ice dungeon, which is the last dungeon I finished before we had to record on here.
Same thing.
Not good.
I finished the whole game before
I'm glad you finished it, so you know that apparently the ending is actually pretty good, that segment, I think it is. So that's good if you actually get that far.
The funny thing about the ending is that, for one thing, you can't, there's no, and your BP doesn't deplete over time, there's no tiredness gauge, it's pretty much just a gauntlet of platforming and combat challenges.
That actually sounds like exactly what I wanted from the game, because I really don't like the BP system. It's so annoying because you can steal powers from enemies and use them, but it's like a horde situation, because I'm like, I need this BP. If I run out of BP and I need it, then I don't know, I'll have to go back to the town and get more, which is a pain in the butt, because I can't hold that many recovery items.
Or you need to carry a whole bunch of recovery items. So a couple of little quality of life things that I just felt like I needed to call out. One, it's not like the sleep system, just every 3 days you need to sleep and then you're cool. That it is constantly accruing, which means if you just happen to get into a boss fight, and the boss fights take place in real game time, if you have an especially long boss fight, Musashi will get sleepy during the boss fight.
And then he will not be able to swing properly, and he'll walk slow.
And then he won't be able to move. Or there's a status effect you can get, poison. If you get poison, poison is effectively, it sets Musashi's animations to maximum tiredness. But
not quite. I actually did discover something really messed up about the tiredness system in this regard, because it also shortens your jump length, which poison does not.
Okay, so it's not quite as bad, but it's still bad enough to where certain boss fights just become annoying.
It's really
not difficult, annoying.
Well, most of the bosses are puzzle bosses, which are just really too long. I like the bosses in the sense that because it's a Squaresoft game, there's a lot of production values in this one, and you know, the bosses look great, they're really cool, I love the locations, they've got lots of frames of animation, they're big, huge things, and there's like cool solutions to fight them, but then you fight them for like 5 or 10 minutes, and it's just like a gauntlet of dodge this attack, dodge this attack, dodge this attack. Yes.
I will say, though, I think what's called the Relic Keeper is both the most guilty of this because of how big a damage sponge the flame is, but also it kind of suffers from the fact that one of the gameplay mechanics doesn't actually seem to work the way you're told until this comes up again later. See, you need, of course, the Water Scroll to douse the flame, you're told that the water attack has autofire, but it seems to be much slower than just smashing the button. Well, unfortunately, if you actually fire into a flame, it's much faster to hold down the button.
Yeah, it does a lot of, and there's a lot of little nuances between the sleepiness. If you die and use the memory box, it takes 50% of your money to restart from the memory box save, which is just an annoying punishment for basically no upside that I could tell. Like, why put this box here if you're going to penalize me for using it? There's the appraisal system, which when you appraise certain items, it gets you basically like a Zelda unlock. You know, sometimes you'll get a double jump or you'll get the ability to walk up icy slopes. But every other item is basically vendor trash. And that vendor trash takes up the same spots in your inventory that all the healing items that you'd want to carry do. So it really incentivizes you to leave slots open.
Yeah, you also mentioned that, but that reminds me of another thing that annoyed me, is that the upgrades themselves, after a point, really aren't all that great. And like, okay, the very first one you get, the ability to climb, that one is cool because you've seen all of these sheer cliffs, so well, it would be handy. And it continues to be useful here and there for the rest of the game. Then you get the double jump, which is also always a useful thing to have. Then you get things like the ability to appraise items the moment you pick them up, which is still kind of useless because the majority of them you still have to bring to the appraisal shop.
Just to sell them, yeah. To get rid of them.
Yeah.
And, of course, the aforementioned shoes that let you run up icy floors, because there is exactly one location in the game that has icy floors.
Which is, of course, where you get the thing. And so, I mean, can you miss those goggles? Because I think that they're optional, aren't they? I can't quite tell if the...
Yes.
So, because...
Yes, you get them in a pool of water in the forest after you get the water quest.
So if you were foolish enough not to do that, you would actually have to... If you got the ice boots, you would have to get the ice boots and then actually go back to town in order to get them appraised, if for some reason you didn't do that, which would be really frustrating.
If for some reason, some sort of idiot, not me, but you know, if some idiot didn't get the goggles, you said goggles. I mean, I got the goggles, so I know. But
yeah,
could you
L
guys?
Goggles.
They were goggles. Okay, they were L goggles.
Imaginary
goggles. I know. But so if you didn't get those, man, it would really suck to double back.
Yeah,
and just in case you were wondering, if someone was so foolish as to have to double back, the mysterious forest doesn't just let you fast travel through it. You have to wander through the mysterious forest a second time, which is not more fun.
And in the game directions you're given for the forest, it's seemingly difficult to understand.
I've been thinking about this, and I basically feel like the puzzle itself it suffers from bad localization and bad translation. I'm sure it makes slightly more sense in Japanese because it kind of makes it hey, do you know shoji or shogi?
Shogi, yes, but that didn't help.
No, it doesn't really help, but because the game gives you information that's only kind of helpful, so you're trying to like, you're like reading through the hints and reading through this, like, all right, how do these fit together? Which part of this fits together? And you also have to kind of, it is like, this is actually like a adventure game, like a point and click adventure game puzzle where you need to think about, it makes sense in retrospect to an extent, but you have to think as the developer thought this puzzle should work. You can't just, it doesn't fit together very cleanly. And there's a couple of puzzles that have that issue. There is the wheel that you need to get, or the gondola gizmo, where two.
Oh, you mean the gondola gizmo?
Yeah, the gondola gizmo. Two of those freaking things are both, like, they both are correct by the game's description, and there is only the most subtle of differences that would technically make one of them correct.
Basically, only some real-world common sense makes one of them the correct choice.
And even that, this game does not operate in real-world common sense land. You're in the all-you-can-eat kingdom. There's a character named... Let's see, which name's the best one to call out here? There's Soldier Lardwick. That's a pretty good name. Shepherd Beefalo. That's
a great
one. You know
who I like? I like Odyssey T-Bone. He is by far my favorite. I want... Like, T-Bone's great. He's he's an artisan, except he's actually a blacksmith, and they call him an artisan for some reason, which is cool. And he has a porn stash and doesn't wear a shirt. He is my favorite character pretty much in the whole game. That's
Janitor Sloppy Joe.
Janitor Sloppy Joe is pretty good. He's like, who messed up my place? Like, I love cleaning because everyone in this game loves their job because that's how it works in Japan, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Knight Rumperoni is pretty good, too.
The, like, saving in a damn hotel and all the, like, shopping stuff for this game is vaguely annoying, except the money part. Because it seems like money is pretty easy to come by.
It depends.
Because it, like, has a spawn rate that is practically NES level, where if you, like, move beyond a screen, like, if you've cleared, like, an area and walk, let's say, the equivalent of, like, 10 foot in a direction and head back, everything is just respawned.
Yeah, if you grind the money.
You can just farm money forever.
So the problem with the money system in this game is that if you are trying to game the system, it's exceedingly easy. If you're just playing through normally, like going through a screen and, you know, trying to make progress, then you don't get very much money at all. So the game is in this weird conundrum where the only way to acquire currency correctly is to play in a degenerate manner where you're just backing out, backing back in. Like it encourages you to play in the least fun way. And that's kind of how this game works on many levels.
Plus, there's also, I mean, that's the main thing you'll be spending on is probably one of the game's cooler features, the action figures.
Damn straight.
That is like this game, I think, is absolutely filled to the brim with Squaresoft-isms. Just so much of this game is like, here's some random bullcrap and some of it is really neat, and the action figures are amazing. I gotta say, like, I bought one in the game and I was like, oh my goodness, this is, wow, they did this, like, holy crap.
Did you leave it mint in box?
Life, I opened the fuck out of it, and mint in sealed box, guys, I'm sorry, but I'm gonna open this stuff, you know. I didn't buy this to die holding a mint and sealed box of something. So, as it is in real life, as it is in the game. And you gotta...
Okay, if you don't care about value.
Well, if I don't... You get a whole new value because when you open them in the game and it opens it with collector-safe packaging, which is really nice, you get, like, a whole different... Like, the characters have action figure moves and action figure accessories that actually do stuff on the screen. And what kind of feature is this?
And one of my favorite things is that, well, it's technically meant does kind of a high-resolution model viewer. They actually do things like model joints and squeals on them like an actual action figure.
And, of course, Musashi's action figure is the proper Musashi, not the diminutive character that we get.
Yeah, that's actually something funny I find, is that a lot of the official art for the game actually does feed... I mean, even if you look at the logo, he looks a lot taller on it than he does in-game.
Yeah, the thing that's amazing to me is that it'd be one thing if the action figure mode just repurposed the models from the existing game. That seems like the thing a reasonable development studio might do. But instead, they remade models specifically for the action figure mode. This feature that has no utility outside of just playing with the little characters. That's it. They don't reuse it anywhere else. It's not like this mode ties into other things. It's not like if you leave things mint in box, you can sell them later on for a value or something. This is just a feature for the lunatics like myself who are going to buy these and just play with them. And let me say, the Root Trick action figure, that's the one you want. He's the best.
He's very expensive too. They have different prices because they're priced at different levels because there are different high levels of quality in them. It's insane.
You know, it's funny you should mention Root Trick because that's another thing about the characters and story I want to point out here that's bothered me, is that the villains are extremely underused in the game. I mean, I actually thought the idea was that Root Trick falls to his death after the tower and after the port where you climb the mountain, only for him to randomly show up in one of the late game cutscenes, do one thing, and then again just sort of vanish from the game.
The plot itself is kind of absent a lot because you basically do some sort of chunk of segment that sometimes. Okay, I'll be fair. Most of the time, it's fairly clear what you're supposed to do. Sometimes it gives you only a vague bit of information. You have to kind of bounce around and talk to people and go to different areas and hope that you stumble upon it. But most of the time, you have a thing that you need to do. But the game doesn't... There's very little going on. It's very... It's weird, because it's like they took some RPG elements in there. So you have this... Like, The game world is kind of dead while you're supposed to do something, and then it refreshes and stuff starts happening again, and then it's like, okay, well, now you got to do this boring thing for like 30 minutes or an hour, and it's like, oh, good.
What I'm trying to say here is that one thing that's kind of bothering me in general is the fact that they introduce all these colorful, cartoonish villains, and they really don't do a whole lot. I mean, like, Will Trick seems like that guy you'd have to face multiple times during the story, or say, like one of those goofball recurring bosses or something. And again, he doesn't really show up much at all beyond his introduction.
I think the catch here is that the game
The sisters, Bubbles and Ginger Way, who, again, don't really do much at all. I mean, they don't even show up in the final dungeon. There's this one cutscene where they accidentally steal a Musashi and a Bincho out and then leave forever.
Yeah. Just put him on the bus.
And then mostly the final dungeon itself actually suddenly takes a ridiculously grim turn compared to the rest of the game, with all of the remaining quirky villains getting killed off in short order.
First, before we get into that, Rootrick's the best. I won't hear anything else. His bad southern accent is amazing. He uses y'all where y'all doesn't belong.
That's true.
And y'all's a very flexible word.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. But his... It's like they never met a Southern person before, and they just hired someone who said that they could do a Southern accent, and they just never tested whether that was true or not. And I really appreciate that. One day I hope to track down the people who did the voice acting in this game to find out what happened. Steve Bloom's in this game. He's actually quite good. You might know him from Cowboy Bebop. He is the only voice. He does the dude who's stuck in the stockades.
Oh, yeah, he's pretty cool. He's the cool guy that's supposed to help you. Does he disappear, like, a quarter of the way through the game?
Yeah.
He's Capricola.
And he's Capricola.
Spoilers for everyone that didn't finish this game before they listened to our podcast.
Well, it's not the same character. It's not the same character. He just voices both.
Oh, okay. So...
No, they are the same guy.
The same guy?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Oh, what?
You get the Southern Post.
What? You work, like, okay, cool. So there is, like, a mild story. I don't hate the story in this game. It's just, it's spaced out a lot, and there's not a lot interesting in the middle of it. Basically, the game is in 6 chapters, and you kind of get a decent-sized cutscene at the start and end, sort of, like, or maybe, like, the start of a chapter and the end, like, midpoint. Like, you don't get many cutscenes. When they're there, they're pretty good. And there might be a downside of the fact that they insisted on voicing everything so that they really didn't include, like, these long... Because Squaresoft, you know, they're pretty good at writing long, not particularly exciting, but you still read them like, yeah, text, I'm reading the text, here we go.
Yeah.
But because you can't read the text, it's all text written, but because it's voiced, I think they got kind of like, ooh, we can't say too much, because otherwise, you know, we'll have to record too much dialogue, which is kind of not good.
I do have a few other things to say also about the combat, which is something I've been meaning to point out that bothered me here, but one other thing, this issue I have is the fact that all too often the enemy, you will accidentally end up engaging the drill move instead of actually attacking.
Oh yeah, that happens so much, it's infuriating.
Yes.
And also the fact that a lot of enemies end up getting sent flying by a final blow, which tends to knock them out of bounds and thus swapping you of any reward for killing them.
Yes. Those are both annoying.
And last but not least, the fact that your combos can only be engaged if an attack lands. So you can't, say, practice any of the techniques you learn from the knights you rescue.
Also, your sword range, and this is why it's kind of difficult, is frustratingly small, which is why you kind of end up grabbing enemies by accident and why combos are tricky to use. Gino, give me your rant. Give me the whole thing.
Okay, I've got a few rants. One, I do like that the combat system has a little bit of depth. I think that there were a lot of good ideas with some of the crests, but many of them turn out to be really only single use. Like, they might be useful in one dungeon or one situation, but you don't keep busting them out in the way you might
most,
in, like, a Zelda
of the time,
game.
But your sword is better for multi-purpose stuff, so you don't use the various spells that you get because it's not worth it.
Exactly. Which is a shame. But the thing that bothered me the most is there's this location called Steamwood. I don't know if you remember it.
Oh, I do.
It is a gigantic tree full of steam that you need to turn some cranks, and if you don't turn the cranks fast enough, it explodes. Now, you would think that sounds like an exciting adventure. I'm going to turn off some cranks. I'm going to, like, mess with some valves and stop this exploding steam tree. But you go there, the way that it works is it's actually a rhythm game, kind of, where you need to watch a bar fill up with steam, and then you press X in the right time, and then it eventually releases the steam. But the way that it works is you've got a 24, it says 24 minutes on the timer, but it's not actually 24 minutes, it's actually like half that time
to
turn off all these valves.
It's 24 in-game hours.
It says 24 in-game hours, and it's really frustrating because, yeah, you need about, I would say, 15 to 20 of those at the bare minimum to get that done. So if you make...
Yes, so...
That's enough of 10.
10? Okay, well, when you need to do it, there are three floors that you need to get to by using an elevator. Each floor has at least three doors that you have to, you know, work with a valve. And every time you use one of the valves and successfully, I guess, release the steam, it gives you like a couple of seconds till you can get to the next one. And if at any point you do not reach the next valve and solve that little mini game in time, it resets all the doors and you have to start all over again, which is hot garbage.
And the elevator walks on its own. You don't have any control over it.
Also, this is one of the major points in the game where I think that it's a fixed camera, which is kind of what it does because it needs to maximize the amount of graphical detail that they cram into the screen. You're trying to like jump into the camera and stuff, and your perspective is completely ruined. I did that tree.
And you have to do this twice.
That's the thing. You have to do this twice. So the first time I did it, I was like, oh, this is, you know, it's bad, but whatever. It's bad, but I'll be done. Then the game asks you to come back again. And the second time, they're like, haha, you've got a double jump now. We're going to mix this up a little bit. So they take some of the wheels off of some of the doors. So you need to find them. They're floating in the background like a freaking coin in a Mario game or something. You have to find them, equip them on the right doors. And then the very first one of the doors that you need to, of one of the valves that you need to use, is a blind jump away. You have to jump from the second floor to the first floor by using your double jump, and it's completely blind. And it's timed. It's all timed. All of it.
There's a lot of frustrating things.
I spent like 30 to 40 minutes of my finite existence on this earth trying to solve Steamwood the second time. I did not. I did not successfully.
I did it on my first try.
Congratulations. I could not. I am bad at jumping.
That's actually
game.
A lot of the elements that are bad about this game. Some of them are different. Like, if I had have done this the first time and gotten further in, I probably would have been like, oh, that was okay. But every time this game throws anything at you that you can mess up, it's like, oh, good, I've got to do that again. Well, I hate this.
So as we're straying into making, let's say, qualitative statements about this game, and considering perhaps maybe where we would rank it, like, so I went back and read a bunch of reviews, and like, it's weird, like the touchstone for this game, like the style of game for a lot of people was like, it's like Zelda, but it's for the PlayStation. Isn't that great? But like, I've been playing a lot of Ys, the Oath and Fel'Ghana recently, and I think it's actually kind of a little more specifically like 3D or like pseudo 3D anyway, Ys style game. But I think this is a worse game than Ys, the Oath and Fel'Ghana.
Definitely.
So that's my starting point, somewhere below there for sure.
My starting point is between Kingsfield Dree and Mischief Makers.
That's okay.
Huh.
I mean, so we've all got the list open. So let me just tell you what's in the Kingsfield 3 range for our listeners out there who don't have the list open.
Yeah.
You might be on a public transport or hate opening spreadsheets. That is 125 on our list, and that is below 123 in The Hunt, 124 Crystallis, and it's above 126 Mischief Makers, and above 127 Broforce. Now, for me, and you know where I'm going with this, I find a hard time enjoying this more than Soul Reaver. I know that obviously I'm going to say that because I like Soul Reaver, but to me, these games are actually really interesting in that they both kind of suffer from a bunch of flaws that were most certainly overlooked at the time because they're like, hey, it's this thing, you know, it's Zelda, or it's you know, this is pretty good and I don't know any better because games are not better than this at the moment. And you know, to me, they're both like, this one is a Japanese example of a game that's not really as good as say, because they're both not as good as like the Zelda games, Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, because they both fall down because they don't necessarily fit all their stuff together. And this game is such a kitchen sink of like stuff, and nothing in this kitchen sink of stuff is like, ooh, that was excellent. It's always like, oh, that missed the mark, or that was so close to being good.
Surprisingly functional.
Okay. So, like, I'm looking a little farther down the list, and there's stuff like, we got so Snatcher, Stalker, Blazing Lasers, Little Samson. Does this go above something like Snatcher?
I I'm looking at this list and I see this. I cannot in good conscience put this above NFL Blitz. I cannot.
Sure. To be clear, it's the original NFL Blitz that we got.
Okay, so that might be the wrong NFL Blitz I'm thinking of, but I still can't put it in good conscience above Sonic the Hedgehog.
Oh, well, that's Sonic. That's Sega Sonic the Hedgehog, by the way. That's the
arcade.
Oh, no. I keep reading these names and thinking they're better games than they are.
Well, I would not have put, like, Sonic the Hedgehog would not be 145 on our list. We would, I don't care how much of a fanboy you are for Nintendo or Sega, like, you, that would be like, no. That's silly. You can't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, for me, I wind up enjoying this one more than Soul Evil on account of the fact that I never felt like I was just slogging through engine issues and the hit detection could still be spotty. It didn't really affect the gameplay as much as it did for me in.
I would definitely agree this game has, because again, it's a Squaresoft game. It has a high level of polish. It's just that the mechanics...
Does it, though?
I don't mean that it's well-designed.
It has its major issues with the engine, I found. I did actually have a platforming segment on the mount that slot where I fell through one of the platforms.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you move fast enough and... for that,
I really wish you got.
You move fast enough, and you typically are teleported right back to where the jump needed to be made. That it didn't
I do appreciate that you don't have lives in this, and you just failure is not overly punished most of the time, except if you die and then you get booted all the way back to your last save, which is not ideal. But that was very normal in the PlayStation period, so I'm not going to be too hard on it for that.
Sure.
One
honestly, I think the overall visual style. And the actual, individual textures in some cases are better than Soul Reaver's. And,
The Ice Palace in this is so good. I looked, when I walked into that building, I was like, oh my goodness. I knew it was PlayStation because it's a bit grainy and you can tell the scenes and stuff.
Kind of,
but I was like, wow, that is a vista for a PlayStation game. That's hot, handcrafted, gorgeous stuff. Someone spent a lot of time on that one room and I didn't have,
Something we haven't talked about at all is the abilities that you acquire with fusion, the things that you steal from enemies. Some of them are actually quite good, bowling. That you get a power that lets you bowl.
The bowling was great because it reminded me of a game that takes that exact idea and makes it really, really fun. And that's Under the Skin by Capcom, I think it was. It's a PlayStation 2 game. It takes the steal people's abilities mechanic and turns it into a fun arcade experience. And it's like, wow, you really... took that idea that Musashi was not quite able to fit because it doesn't really make sense in what kind of game this is. It's just kind of
it's just
a
fun.
Cool idea that they put in, but it doesn't do
I think one of the most infuriating things is that you can't actually take any of the abilities from the Frozen Palace with you. And that has things like the drop kick and the haul, but nope, to actually leave the Frozen Palace, you have to get that stupid hop ability.
Right. That's this whole, thing about this this game.
This game's
and yeah,
good,
like,
but not great.
No, it's yeah. yeah
Which it is this, right this entire section of this list is kind of littered with those games. For a long time, about the dead center of this list, for a long time listeners will be familiar with this, was Donkey Kong Country 3, which is the definition of competent, but I don't want to play it ever again. And kind of everything directly north of there is it was okay. I don't know how I managed to get Blassen's Black Bass above that, but I did, and I feel very proud of that.
We didn't have many fishing games, so I guess that's pretty fair. I will say, in the terms of the PlayStation hierarchy, Guardians Crusade is 148, and I do think this game pulls off stuff better than Guardians Crusade, if only because Guardians Crusade is one note the whole time, and sometimes it's good, but most of the time it's kind of frustrating. I appreciate that, this game does kind of add things, even if it's why is this now the thing that we're, I guess we're doing this now. But I guess at least it's got that going on where you kind of, the mechanics are never super great, but at least they got a lot of them. And it's
the game I'm staring at is Stalker Shadow of Chernobyl. I think this game is probably worse than Stalker, but probably better than Dead or Alive 3. How does that range sound to you?
That sounds reasonable. My one problem with Stalker is the sheer amount of modding you have to do to really make that one functional the way it was supposed to be. And that's always a big ding for me. The reason I'm really was really hard on it and Soul Weaver is the fact that there's so much cut out of both of those games that they end up not quite, like, I don't know how to put this. Like,
well, yeah, they feel like something is missing. Like, they do. Like, those games just, you're like, is this a mechanic that I was supposed to use? What is this area for? It's just here.
This one, it feels complete, but also like a tech demo, basically.
It's definitely a tech demo. I have no doubt that Square were like, we're going to work on this technology, you know, this real-time 3D stuff. We're going to get this really well, and we're going to make a kid's game, because kid's games sell, even if the quality is not 100% there, so we're not taking a big risk on it. And my main thing is, whereas Stalker and Soul Reaver, and I guess even kind of Pilot Wings as well, which is just below Soul Reaver, I like that, well, actually, no, this Pilot Wings, sorry, is a lot closer to this game, in that this game, it keeps running you through areas you've been through over and over again. Like, they only have so many areas, and to me, that gets more and more laborious, and I prefer the way it does it in Shadows of Chernobyl and Soul Reaver, where even if it's not completely finished, and they most definitely are not, at least, like, I feel like when I make progress, I go to new areas, and I really, like, the fourth or fifth time I went through the mines, and the sixth time I stumbled up the mountain, I'm like, where is this Weaver? I don't know where the Weaver is, and I'm just looking, and the music in those areas is not always great, and that's actually what
I still admit. I do not get Swift Forest having this spooky forest sound when it's not the least bit spooky.
It's also the first environment you go to, and it's got this like really creepy track, and I'm like, oh man, am I even supposed to be in here? I'm getting chased by like these monsters that are teleporting in, and everything is kind of trying to kill me. Am I in the right area? I was really off-put at the start of this game.
Gunheart, how do you feel about this game relative to Pilot Wings? Because I think you're our resident Pilot Wings 64 fan.
Well, I do admit I liked Pilot Wings 64 more than this one.
How do you feel about Blazing Lasers?
I've never played that one.
Blazing Lasers is like, this is a great shmup launch title game. Like, yeah, that's
has way better name in Japan. It's just called Gunhead, isn't it?
There's Gunhead or it's Blazing Lasers, which are both great names for different reasons.
All right, so Brave Fencer Musashi is worse than Gunhead or Blazing Lasers. Little Samson?
I think this one goes below Pilot Wings 64 and above Snatcher. How do we feel about that?
I can live with that.
I think I could. I still didn't like Soul Weaver nearly as much, but I'll take what I can get.
I didn't want to be the deciding vote on this because I didn't want to force it to go above or below Soul Reaver because I thought that was unfair because I'm obviously biased to Soul Reaver. So if the other two people here, other than myself, are like under Pilot Wings is good, then I'm comfortable with that as long as it's
all
like,
right.
Everyone's That's happy about it.
That's it. That works. We're putting it. It is now the 131st game.
That's apparently Yay. Where it goes, yes. I hope we don't get any blowback, because Snatcher is like, we keep putting things above Snatcher, and we didn't put Snatcher the high, but no one seems to care very much. It's just like, yeah, that's fine. Like,
to be honest, I have this weird desire now to replay the sequel now that I don't have the whole...
You want to hear some bad voice acting,
I played Samurai Legend back when it was new, but it was still years after I had played Brave Fencer Musashi, so that one had a lot of nostalgia appeal. So now I'm kind of wondering which one really is the worst game now.
So, Gino, before we sign off on this particular recording, I want you to say, would you actually recommend people play Brave Fencer Musashi in this day and age? What would you say?
So, I would say it depends on whether you want to play a fun game that you're going to enjoy or if you want to see a curiosity, you know? If you just want to see how things used to be back when we had to walk uphill both ways to school. If you want to see what that was like and, you know, before we had things like voice acting directors and talent, then you should totally check out Brave Fencer Musashi. It has a lot of charm.
Thank you. Hey listeners, this is Mike, the real-life alter ego of Satenga, and the self-admitted weakest link of TG47K's regulars. But if you don't think I'm totally dragging down the quality of the podcast, then hear me out. I've been writing for Hardcore Gaming 101 since I was in high school, and I'm proud to see the site flourish. But it could always use more help for the benefit of its creator, Kurt, especially since he's paying us for these episodes now. If you want to get more incentive for Xerxes, Cal, Bobinator, our editor Jeff, and myself, along with our other friends and guests to put on the best damn show we can, make a pledge at www.patreon.com/HG101. If John Madden gets paid to say obvious things about sports, shouldn't we get rewarded for babbling about video games? If you agree, that's www.patreon.com/HG101. Thank you, and peace forever!
Our next game is Magic Pengel, The Quest for Color. It was nominated by iBrimley on iTunes. It was developed by Garakuda Studio and Taito. It was published in Japan by Taito, and in the US by HTech. Its platform was the PlayStation 2, and it was released earliest in Japan on March 20th, 2002. Which kind of sits it as, this is like, wow, PlayStation 2, like the most regular time period for a PlayStation 2 release, like 2002. Like, this was PlayStation 2's going strong. Weird, quirky games are going to come out. This game is weird and quirky as hell.
Yes. Yes, it is. From the makers of Graffiti Kingdom comes Magic Pengel, The Quest for Color.
This is one actually predates.
Yeah, except in reverse.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is a really, I mean, it is what it says. You have Magic Pengel.
Yes.
That's the game.
So this game is kind of incredible because basically the core mechanic, you are a nameless, faceless child. You start on this world. You're just kind of in what seems like the outskirts of a town. And you're just kind of given this book that when you draw in it with this creature, this flying baby that has a tail that seems to be some sort of paintbrush. When you draw things with it, they come to life. And they have one desire, and that is to kill. And you must sate you must sate their blood. You must sate their desire for blood in the octagon. And you can draw all kinds of things, but there's only one rule, and it's that whatever you draw must be an abomination. It seems to me that the people who made this game had access to a tool set that I did not, or had a level of patience and motor skills that I do not have. And so you draw things.
Well, a little bit of backstory. This is actually using a heavily modified version of a program by independent software developer Takeo Igarashi. In fact, you can still download the original program known as Teddy from his official website.
But I guess we should note that the software Taito has used has been heavily modified by the technical talent at Taito, because the one that you'll have access to if you download it is not as complicated. It doesn't have the actual autofill as good. I don't think it does, and it definitely doesn't use the same cell shader real time stuff that you get access to in Pengel.
Which the one you can download is basically a prototype.
But definitely the Taito team would have drawn their stuff on a tablet, I would have guessed, or some sort of a pen device, which is one of the weaker aspects of this game, is that although you have the analog sticks, but yeah, you have to draw terrifying monster things because it's not on a system that gives you a tablet or even like a mouse. So you can't
get it's those. Like, it's like this and Okami were like the two big PS2 games that were like, what if you could draw with this controller? But Okami kept it fairly simple, where it's like, draw a line or draw a crude circle. And I guess this game kind of works around the limitations of the controller by kind of being like, I don't know, draw a monster.
Yes.
Just draw like shapes and slam them together and we'll figure it out for
exactly.
You.
It does figure it out really well.
Yeah, the part where it's figuring it out for you is far and away the most interesting part of this game. It seems
the amazing,
totally
really gorgeous. Amazing part is that everything is animated as well.
Yes.
I mean, right.
Yes.
It's crazy.
It's important to mention these. When you start the game, you only have access to like bodies. I don't even know if you have arms. I think it's just like a body, hard bits, soft bits, wiggly bits.
Yeah.
Like you have a couple of bits. You don't even have access to a head when you start drawing. The game gives you a couple of colors to start, and you just kind of have to draw a creature. And as you as your creature devours the souls of other Pengels and other doodles, it will eventually get the ability to add more and more color to itself. And then once you max out on color, that is as complex. Once you max out the like amount of color you can draw, that is as complex as your drawings can get. And
it's kind of clever in that way, because
yes.
you your drive to go forward, because a lot of a lot of similar games like Drawn to Life, or if you go to something like Spore, it kind of just is like, well, you can use all the bits pretty early on, and so you just unlock like more stuff, or you just kind of get like extra things to like dick around with. Whereas this game, it actually like play the game more to get access to the other limbs and the other colors and extra stuff.
Yeah.
So your drive to play the game is actually like, ooh, I want to get more stuff to draw better. And that's pretty cool. I think that's a nice like touch in how they balance the game.
Yeah, and one of the things that's kind of important is this game, like the creatures that you draw do not actually necessarily matter in terms of what your stats are. So the stats of the creatures that you draw are determined largely by the colors you use. So if you use blue, yeah, I think it becomes more magic centric. There's three different types: attack type, magic type, and defense type. And whichever one of those types your creature is, they will kind of lean in the rocks, paper, scissors combat system that Pendril uses. They'll kind of favor whichever one they have the most, you know, their color aligns them with. So if you just draw a giant blob of blue with almost no limbs, you will actually have different attacks than if you had drawn arms or legs or a head, but your health and some of your other stats don't necessarily care all that much. It just cares how much color you have.
And so, yeah, so then what you do is you can go to the town, which is really nicely rendered. I think the whole game has a very nice look to it. Everything just looks pretty great. I was very impressed looking at this game. Like, this is definitely a PlayStation 2 game, but Taito really knocked it out in terms of the way it looks and the colorful cast of characters that you fight against, and not just the Pendrils that they've drawn, but like the weirdos that are basically the world's like Pokemon Master kind of Pokemon Trainer equivalents, who are a bizarre menagerie of characters that are...
Of course, the graphical fidelity does have its cost in the fact that there isn't a whole lot of worlds to explore.
Yeah.
No, it's a very small universe. I think, I mean, so, like, it's pretty obvious with this game that they were like, okay, this technology that this guy made is really cool, let's get it into our game. And then they did a really great job of it, and we're like, okay, well, I guess now we need a game, so it's like Pokemon fights, except it's rock, paper, scissors, which...
Yes.
It's about the best I think that they could have done in terms of like without it just completely falling apart the moment anything happens. So you kind of do have your Pendrils kind of feel like, oh, this one's kind of unique and different, but only
just
barely.
Just one thing I'd like to say. The Pendril is the name for the little creature that serves as your cursor and drawing. The creatures themselves are called doodles.
Yes.
I cannot call them doodles because that basically just means, penis where I'm from, so it's completely...
Well, I guess you're going to have to call it that more than everyone else does in that case.
Well, I can say it, but I don't really want to just keep saying doodle over and over, because it basically, yeah, it's, it is like a two meaning word, but you don't...
That's pretty good. I mean...
Yeah, you don't use it.
I'm sorry. There. I'm sorry for that. But this...
Yeah. No, so like if I say play with your doodle, that's like, that's filthy. That really is just completely filthy. I can't say that.
I'm sorry. My headphones cut out for a second. What'd you just say? Say that again one more time.
I guess, you know, if I get caught on recording telling people to go out there and play with their doodles,
the government
will arrest me because they're against that sort of thing now. So it's just,
okay.
We have to call them something
Turnbull,
else.
Cracking down on those doodle touchers,
yeah,
man.
Thank goodness.
If you're a doodle toucher.
Put them on that island over there.
They put you on the island with Zoe and Taro. Yeah, so this game, as you unlock different abilities, like, you basically just keep going to these trials. And every time you go to these different preliminary matches, you're gifted further colors, further options for, like, limbs and things to draw. And the story advances. And it's kind of an incredible story that this game tells, and I did not think that this would be the case at all when I started playing it. You basically start out with Zoe and Taro, who are like basically homeless. They own a shack on the outskirts of town that seems like their dad is gone, and it's threatening to be repossessed by the evil government, the evil empire that seems to run their town. And as you keep winning matches, like, they come... The evil emperor, like, comes and they rough up Taro and Zoe, and, like, they say, this land is ours now. And then Taro and Zoe have to try and find a way to get the money to buy their land so that the government doesn't take their land away. And then this kid named Mono, this blonde kid, shows up, and this blonde kid has special powers. Do you know what his special power is? Did anyone play enough to know his special power other than Gunheart, Jeff, or anyone?
I'm trying to remember because I know I actually have seen the scene where Blondie shows up, but
yeah, Blondie's power is he can steal the color from things and make color crystals out of them. But the next time the evil government, like, he befriends Zoe and her brother, and the next time the evil government comes to stomp on their land and take their dad's shack, he uses his power to try to suck the color out of a living human being. Yeah. It's like a forced choke, but somehow even more savage. And the guy just writhes in pain on the ground as the color is leaving him. And then Zoe's like, no, Mono, not like this. And he lets the guy go. But Mono has this power. And then they say, instead of killing these government people, we're going to go to an underground fighting ring. This doodle fighting ring. They go to an underground ring that's guarded by a shady character. And Mono just like whips people in this cockfighting ring to get the money that they need to save their house.
The show is now banned in Australia.
I'm sorry. Because he's apparently, Mono's a great doodler, but guess what, guys? Mono is a doodle.
My. Yeah.
Man. I mean,
what can't be true.
It's just so amazing because it's like they could have done nothing with the story and it would have been
right.
Effectively almost the same. Like, it's awesome that the story goes in this bizarre direction, but from like the technology and the actual gameplay, I don't think it would have made a huge
nope.
difference. But someone was like, let's make
I think I have to wonder how much is Arch may have been the influence of Studio Ghibli, though, here.
Yeah,
right,
well,
so Studio Ghibli probably mentioned
like, do they have some kind of contractual obligation about the game's storyline before they'll provide art for it or something?
I have no clue, but they... If whoever said we need to have a blonde boy that can steal the color out of humans and make them writhe in pain, because that's what this game about drawing little dogs needs, good work, good on them. But
and it is interesting because, yeah, like if you've never seen this game, it really looks like, you know, it's just kids game, like very kids game. Like it's bright and colorful yeah. and everything's kind of like happy-go-lucky. And yeah, it does take dark turns, which is kind of out of nowhere because the gameplay is still like draw cute things or yeah. draw weird looking things. Lots of penises. If you Google it online, you know, if you type magical pen gel and you look at all the characters people have made, but especially the game's sequel, Graffiti Kingdom, which is a not quite a sequel, but that had a share your doodle mode, which
oh,
I
no.
don't think this one has. But so, yeah, on Graffiti wait, Kingdom, if you had the online functionality on the PS2, I think you could swap doodles with people.
You mean to tell me that there were a lot of doodle doodles?
It has tons of doodle doodles. There's doodles off the walls, and I saw someone, because of course, guess what? I saw someone draw Rick from Rick and Morty, everyone. Rick's in it, too, you know, gotta...
Oh, wow.
Gotta, yeah, that's how up to date Graffiti Kingdom is. People are still making.
Sure, we've been talking a lot about like the cool like you can draw shapes and this game has a plot and that's neat. I think that's all in service of not talking about what you actually do most of the time, which is basically play like rock paper scissors plus house
yeah,
rule.
Yeah, the house rule is there's a fourth option, a secret fourth option, and the option is charge, and when you charge up. When you charge up, it heals you. So every pendulum has health. And then you've got three you've got your rock, your paper, your scissor, and charge. So rock is physical attack. Physical attack beats defend, which I guess in this case would be scissors. And then defend beats magic, which would be, I guess, paper. Wait, I think I'm screwed up, but it doesn't matter. Defend beats magic. Magic beats attack. Attack beats defend. And charge is neutral. It is not
just
weak to any of them.
Attack beats defend. That is so weird. Yes. Like, that just, like...
It makes sense in the game because, like, the defend command usually appears as kind of like this energy barrier that physical attacks shatter and magic attacks just kind of...
Yeah, no,
I can't.
Yeah, I have seen the shield. It just kind of like it just immediately comes off as unintuitive that defending is beaten by attack. Like that's
yes,
just a bit yeah. of a weird step. But this game also, I believe, the way your characters work, they kind of do a little bit of things on their own. Like you give them, you say do magic, and you don't get to choose what they do. They'll just go like, I'll use my magic.
So with magic, you do get to pick. With
magic, you get to pick, but attacks, you don't.
Yes, attack is just like you get there's a random list of attacks they could do. And then with defend, it is always the same defend. And that depends on what type of pen, what type of doodle you have. If you have a attack doodle, their defend is the weakest. It just kind of, if you successfully defend, it just does some damage to your opponent. If you have a magic character and you do defend, and you successfully defend, you deal a little bit less damage to them, but you absorb the MP from the attack they did to you. So it helps heal your MP, which a magic user will expend pretty quickly. And then if you're a defense type, your defend will reflect the magic spell's effect back at the caster. So if someone casts a very powerful spell on you and you successfully defend against it, you will screw them up real bad.
And so the way this works also, a lot of Japanese games are pretty pretty big fans of like the rock, paper, scissors sort of mechanism. Like it's a very popular thing that they do.
Yeah, Junkin is very popular.
Yes. I was like, I know the word, but I don't know the word exactly, so I'm not going to even try. But thank you. So yeah, but this one, you exhaust your attacks, which adds your layer of strategy, is that you cannot repeat in one section. Like if you choose to attack, you can't just be like, attack, attack, attack. You actually have to cycle your moves out because it exhausts them based on which one you've used.
When your other touchstone is like the pie conversation minigame from Oblivion, you really got to start like take a step back and think about what you've done as a society. But that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, I mean, this game, one of the problems with the balance of Magic Pendulum is that magic types, basically any magic type that has the faint spell, any of the faint spells are ridiculously overpowered because magic, there are a couple of different status effects that magic can afflict. Physical attacks never afflict status effects. They just tend to hit really hard. And the defense abilities only ever kind of either hit the opponent really hard or like bounce the effects that they were sending at you back at them. So really the magic is where you get some extra layers of depth of strategy. And first you've got some that are like locks that will stop opponents from using certain abilities. You get some that put a curse on some of the rocks, paper, scissors options, that if your opponent picks those options, they take damage for using them. There's one that's called balloon, where after a certain number of turns, the balloon will pop and drip onto your opponent and deal them extra damage. There's some that just like do extra damage, but feint knocks, if it works, knocks your opponent unconscious for 2 rounds and you can just wail on them and they can't fight back.
This is a really common RPG issue where if status effects or status abilities or that sort of thing work really well, then they're mandatory and they're super powerful and you just want them. Or if they don't work well, then you just ignore them completely. So clearly this is in the... if you have these status effects, apply them liberally because you will win a lot. But I don't really think, like... To me, this is not the kind of game where you are trying to min-max. You can min-max because it's a game that gives you the ability to min-max. But I think also a fun of the game is refining your character. Be like, I want a character that does these specific things. I want to draw them in like a fun way and try and get like an interesting character to work out of that rather than I want to win this game as quickly and as efficiently as possible, which I think is not.
Admittedly, this is where the big problem comes in, and that would be the fact that the final boss fights are ridiculously difficult.
Yes, that is the problem. Like, I was with you until you get to the final dungeon. Once you get to the final dungeon, it is just banger after banger after banger coming at you. Like, all these fights that are so strong that you can't just have fun with it. You have to have these very specific doodles that are capable of taking on what's coming at you. And that's when I just always went, okay, when my opponent doesn't have defend, that means they can't stop me from casting my magic. I'm going to cast feint, and then I'm just going to hit them as hard as I can.
Right. And that's, you got to the end of the game. They're like, all right, well, time to put a wall for the player to throw themselves at because this is serious time now. Don't beat the game. They know
something
like that.
The story that leads you to this final dungeon is that it turns out Zoe and Taro's father was kidnapped by the Empire and forced to make doodles for them, illicit doodles, powerful doodles, to create the Doodle King, the one true doodle that would have the power of color. And that doodle is Mono, the little blonde boy, the little blonde doodle boy. Mm-hmm. He is the Doodle King. And when you go to this dungeon, he gets taken. He voluntarily like turns himself in to save Taro and Zoe. And you have to find him. So you go to this castle, and wandering the halls of the castle are all of the reject Doodle Kings, all of the other doodles that were drawn by other doodlers that weren't good enough. And they all shout it. They all start every battle by saying, I am the Doodle King. And then you have to put them down. These monsters, these abominations.
Okay, I just want to take one moment to give a slight question on something. Graffiti Kingdom actually is the direct, is actually a sequel in Japan, because this game, so the original Graffiti Kingdom, and what we got as Graffiti Kingdom was Graffiti Kingdom 2.
Huh.
Right, so they changed.
And apparently the second game is actually a direct prequel, apparently.
Great.
Well, okay. There is, I believe, a small canon successor to this one.
No, wait, I read that wrong. They don't have any story relation.
But they are connected by name. But no, there is two characters, Zoe and Taro, I think it is. They show up later in a Taito game for the DS, and they're a little older in that game. Sorry, I can't remember the name of that game offhand, but they do show up. So this game does have a small connection to a similar style of a monster fighting game that they made for the DS. Feel free to look that one up, but I love the direction this game goes in. Like, it goes all Aliens Resurrection, where they just have like melty face monsters. Kill me, kind of. Wow,
every single one of them says the same thing. They say, "I am the Doodle King," and then you defeat them. And after that, they're like, "I was not the true Doodle King," and the voice acting is very bad. It seems to be the same voice actor, and then they'll say some exposition about what's going on in the Doodle Kingdom, and once you've defeated all of them, you make your way to the top of the tower, and there's a very important moment. So up until this point, there's this famous doodler who is supposed to take the place of Zoe, who took the place of Zoe and Taro's dad, because Zoe and Taro's dad died. And when he died, Mono was at his bedside when he died. And so that was what made Mono realize he was a real boy. And this new supreme doodler realizes that he cannot create a better doodle or another Doodle King. So he tries to get Mono to join him. And I forget if he's going to overthrow the evil empire, or he wants to use Mono to be some sort of tool. And Zoe and Taro tell Mono that he doesn't need to be a tool. He shouldn't be a tool. And Mono, at first, he's like, "No, I am. I'm going to be evil." And then they're like, "No, Mono, you've got a heart." And Mono's like, "You're right. I do have a heart." And then the doodler, who up until this point has been giving you all these like helpful hints and all these accessories and stuff, he pulls out a gun and he shoots Zoe. He shoots Zoe in her chest. He just shoots her in her damn chest and she falls. He shoots a child in the chest.
Oh.
What is this with both of our games having characters inexplicably pull guns in the final cutscenes?
It's really important to mention, at no point up until this has there been any mention of any weapons of any kind other than doodles that maybe I drew a doodle that looked like a gun. But up until this point, there are no swords, there's no saws, like there's nothing. If this guy pulls a pistol out of his jacket pocket and shoots a like 12-year-old kid in the chest so that this blonde thing will do his bidding, and then he loses, he screams, and then all color is wiped away from the universe, and then you have to fight him. And he becomes like a DBZ boy, and you fight him. And then after that, he becomes after you beat that form, he becomes like a big phoenix bird looking thing. And then if you beat him after that, it turns out Zoe survived her gunshot wound. And he moves on. Zoe and Taro leave their little town, and they go on an adventure or something.
Which they show up in some indeterminate DS game later, is how that continues.
This game's incredible. This game is amazing.
Yeah, so on the scale of 1 to the ending of Final Fantasy X, how do you rank
that? Oh, it's one of the greatest endings of any game I've ever seen. I've never seen a game just so needlessly shoot a child. Seen games that do it with purpose. I've seen games that foreshadow that something bad might happen to a kid. I've never seen a game produce a gun out of thin air to shoot a kid in the chest for anime reasons. And
I want that Watch Mojo list.
There's directed by John Carpenter.
Mono, when you're talking to him, Mono, when you beat, I think it's when you beat his first form or something, or when you fight his first form, he says, "I don't have feelings." And it's just the best. It's a great, man, this game's good.
So we got to talk about ranking this game. But the problem is, how do you rank this?
You put it at 1 and then you walk away.
Well, I mean, I'm used to lots of angry blowback, so I guess we can do that. I don't see any problem.
It's fair. I mean,
I do think Super Mario 64 is a little high on this list, just so I can get some blowback on this episode.
This game, so the part where you play Magic Pendulum, is pretty mediocre because it's rocks, paper, scissors. The part where you draw, pretty okay. I mean, it's the best drawing that you can do on the PS2, and it comes to life.
Not quite. The sequel does it better since you actually have a copy and paste function.
God damn. Can you delete individual things instead of having to like undo?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Game changer.
This changes a lot.
That would have been nice.
In this game's defense, I think its renderer is a lot nicer. The renderer in Graffiti Kingdom or Graffiti Kingdom 2 or whatever you want to call it is just kind of like a pretty bland Gaussian sort of, you know, flat sort of texture with some shadowing on it, which is not as fun as I think as the cell shading in this, which glitches out a little bit, but looks really nice and actually kind of, I think, is fun, whereas that one is a bit... It shows off the tech better, but it's less visually interesting. I think the thing about this one is we do have to sort of measure it against like fun to play, because this game is, I guess, a bit of a slog. The further you get through it, the more you're doing the same thing. So, I mean, like, what is the best way? Because I happen to know, because I was watching them. I believe there's plenty of Let's Plays, or at least a couple of decent ones online that you can watch, which may be if you're not great at drawing or don't have access to a copy of the game because you don't live in NTSC countries, might be the better way to experience the gripping story, which is not great for a game when it's kind of like, just skip the gameplay. I don't know, makes it tough at a rank.
Right, then you can't really skip the gameplay because the fun of the gameplay is actually drawing your own things, so that's a weird sort of limbo to land in.
Right, and I mean, it's not this game's fault. I think, like, tech-wise, and the way, I think this game does do, like, if you were to try and make this game in the sense that, like, take all the ideas that they're trying to put into it, take the technology into it, I think that they did a bang-up job of actually getting all those ingredients together. Like, I think that was a real hurdle, because most games that have character designers or character builders, either the character builder is limited or doesn't do anything, or it's really complicated and does a lot, but the game sucks. And I think this one just barely manages to kind of cram them together in a way that's actually functional, which I think is impressive, even if it's not like a 10 out of 10 best sort of game experience.
Yeah.
Right.
Personal problem overall, and makes it hard for me to wink it's particularly high, is that they're just... Outside of the drawing, there isn't a whole lot to it. I mean, there's not really much you can do with your doodles outside of the rattle of bland rock, paper, scissors combat.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You can unleash them on your farm and walk by them and ogle them.
Which is neat.
Which
I like that touch.
It's better than not being able to ogle them.
I'm looking like PlayStation 2 RPGs. On this list, for instance. Now, I'm not saying we should throw it at the spot, but the one that springs to mind immediately for me is Evergrace, just because of how, like...
Well, it has a lot more going for it than Evergrace.
Yeah, but, like, how much... I mean, like, parts of this game are really cool. Like, the part where you make stuff, way cool. Like, awesome. It's just not much of a game, and that's, like, really damning in my head.
I don't know exactly where to start, then, for not much of a game, but still cool. Why don't we start at Spirits of Xanadu?
Oh.
That's 154 on the list.
Okay. I can... So...
right next to Donkey Kong Country.
Hey, Donkey Kong Country 3, how you doing?
Hi, yeah, nice to see you again. Where's UN Squadron?
Right yes,
now,
our true that was our other of the good games. 105.
How can this... Huh. So, I maybe you missed a part. A guy, he pulls out a gun, and he shoots this kid right in the... She falls. She goes down. She looks like she's dead. And then the game keeps happening.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop.
The tech behind the game pushes this one quite high, because...
Yeah.
And
did you notice that when you're walking through town, there's multiple stores that just say, flesh?
I
think that they meant meat, but God, thank goodness they didn't.
I think it was supposed to be flesh, but you know, the all thing.
I would have thought someone would have caught that in I guess they're just selling flesh. That's fine. We'll just leave it. I do think this game is in the pantheon of games, pretty much 100% unique. Graffiti Kingdom is a different style of game.
Yeah.
This one is really you cannot say, boy, I wish I could play Magic Pen Gel, but give me a different game that isn't that. You'd be like, don't know.
Okay, Okay, I got one. A game that is like incredibly unique for specific reasons. Transarctica.
I like Transarctica, but
which it was basically you and me, because like that game is like if you just get rid of everything else around it, it's kind of a management sim in some ways. But when you actually look at Transarctica, it's basically like the bleakest version of Snowpiercer fan fiction ever written. For the
it's amazing.
Like it's, if you've not experienced Transarctica, really, you should definitely check it out. Anyone listening to this should check it out because it is really like a atmosphere dense game, just so. Yeah. But I do think that
that does put it right. That puts it below Musashi, which we just talked about. Which I guess maybe you know how do we that feel about it relative me. To?
I do think me. That this game puts itself over the edge, mostly because. The story is cool in a way that it didn't have to be. I guess the real question that we have to look at ourselves here is how much the game's battle system lets it down in a practical sense. Because I don't think they could have done much better with it. It's just whether, you know, whether you hit like a glass ceiling here where it's like, as much as this game is cool and interesting, is it just like, yeah, but we can only recommend it because it's cool and interesting, not because you're going to love getting through it.
I would say this game, what it lacks in depth, there's something about the range of doodles you can produce and yet the animations still work. Like, there's just a fundamental magic to being able to see these creations that you've drawn animate in a reasonable way and see their attacks change as you update them and change them. It doesn't have as many things as something like a Musashi, but what is there is well executed on a level that some of the other games that I'm seeing on this list, like, they're cute. It's nice that they have all these ideas, but many of them fail to reach the level that they should. This is a game that shoots, you know, medium and hits. But then there's this story part that's amazing. Underground, literally underground, fighting ring for doodles. It's illicit. It gets raided. They raid the underground doodle fighting ring. It's amazing.
I am loving where that's going. I love this whole, like, this thing. I mean, I'm definitely into this sort of experience. I really, really bothers me that because Squaresoft actually owned the license to this game now and this stuff now, which is kind of interesting. They bought Taito. There's never been a re-release on like a tablet or the PC with a pen or something. Like, this is the perfect like mobile game sort of experience. You know, you can draw your freaking doodles. You can draw doodle on your doodler. You know, it's perfect for being re-released. And I'm bothered that they don't release it as like a game that you can do on a more modern system. Yeah. But I do want to have to...
Cal, we got to get you to put your doodle out on the table and spot on this
I list. Mean, I think that it probably, in terms of weirdness and how well the tech works, that's what I'm looking at here. Like, I like unique, weird things. That's like one of the things that I'm really into. So I would probably put this around the SinStar range, I think, which is 103 at the moment, just because I can't see a sort of experience that you kind of... There is no alternative experience for this, and I appreciate the way the game works in that if you don't like your doodle, unlike in real life, you can just change to a different doodle. You can immediately scrap your doodle and make a new doodle. Like, there's no, you have to pay to make a new doodle, or you have to throw away the ink. It's just, don't like that one? Scrap it. Make a new one. And that's really cool that they're like, just here's the fun part of the game. We're going to give you as much of that as we can. Play the game, which has a weird-ass plot, to get more of the fun part of the game. And it doesn't hold back much. And the only problem is that there's a 11th hour endless boss rush, which is not
a bummer.
That great.
But there is, you can challenge all of the people in town to battles by the sea. And then when you beat them, they give you the colors that they have a lot of. It's great.
What do you guys think around SinStar? Is this good? Is this too high?
So
is this
I'm looking low? Around that area. It can't be higher than Marvel vs. Capcom or Street Fighter 3. I mean, it's good.
Oh, wow. You're one of those.
I mean, those are solid games. I just think that, like,
that's our fighting game dense zone right there is now.
Yeah.
We're like, fighting games, we don't know what we're doing.
If you look,
here.
We actually,
sorry,
Marvel vs. Capcom 2 and Capcom vs. SMK2 were the same episode, and we basically just punted, and we're like, they're born to live together.
Yeah, like,
these are just, like, destined for
I like the order you put them in.
So, okay, if we're not going to do that, because there's no way I'm going to push it higher than Mr. Pengel himself right here, Gino. Well, what do we say underneath that? Because I would put it above Dynamite Cop. I love Dynamite Cop, but it is the ultimate in just like 15 minutes, one or two times through, and never really bothered to touch it again. Whereas this, when I see this game, I'm like, I really want to draw those characters. You know, I really want to get in there and see what happens when I draw things. You know, it's not even like that would be really cool to do. And I don't like, I think anyone that sees this game and says you can draw something and it comes to life, they'll be like, is that witchcraft? Is that wizardry? Does it? And it's like, no, it seriously actually works, which is amazing for a PS2 game to actually do that and work.
This is one of the few games that I actually like booted up and was able to play with my wife, because she does not like games nearly as much as I do. But drawing weird abominations was so much fun that she was able to get into it just from that perspective. And the Rocks, Paper, Scissors is so simple that she could still play that as well. Like, there's not that much crazy rules density that she, you know, was scared away, which I think is actually a plus.
All right.
For the audience.
So, controversial suggestion here. What if we crammed it between MVC2 and CVS2?
I like that.
Just to give them a
story. Right. That SNK.
Just to break them up a little bit.
You can put it in a fighting game sandwich. It is almost a fighting game in its bizarre rock, paper, scissor way.
In the sense that Pokemon is a fighting game.
It definitely is. You know, it's a cockfighting game.
It's a type of fighting. Type of fighting that was outlawed.
Very much, for good reason. I'm pretty happy with that. Is everyone here completely happy with that? Or at least relatively happy?
My heart says it should be higher, but my mind says this is correct.
Gunheart, how do you feel?
I still think, basically, I'm more into it as a drawing program than a game, and thus can't really wink it that high, but I'm outwinked here, so I'm not going to...
I think that's a fair assessment, especially like, but I love that, you know, it's simple enough that anyone can get into, which is perfect for what it is. And I think that's why people didn't like Graffiti Kingdom is interesting, because I think people that like, that really want to play like a more traditional game, like Graffiti Kingdom a lot more. But the people that got on board for the drawing stuff were like, I actually like Pendulum more because it's a little bit simpler, which is interesting. We're going to put it in. We're going to put it, in between Marvel vs. Capcom 2 and Capcom vs. SNK 2. And it is Graffiti Kingdom 1, or Magical Pengel everywhere else. Oh, what was it? The Quest for Color, which absolutely does not summarize the actual contents of the story, apparently.
Mono went on a quest to rob the color from living beings. And sometimes he succeeds, sometimes he doesn't.
Magic Pengel, the little girl gets shot in the chest, just didn't work very well with like the test audience, so they went
Magical
with
Pengel, the dog dies at the end, kind of. We'll put it in at 110 and walk away. Thanks, everyone, and thank you, Gino, for being with us and really schooling us on Pengel. I would have never, ever in my wildest dreams gotten that much information about Pengel out.
When I played this game and rediscovered it, I expected it to be mediocre. But then my heart was touched, just like Zoe's heart was touched by that bullet. And now I love this game.
And hey, if you want to hear Gino and another cool Giant Bomb dude talk about Magic Pengel for around an hour or so, where would you go do that?
You would do so at deeplistens.libsyn.com, which is the Deep Listens podcast, the podcast I host or co-host. And you could find our Magic Pengel episode, which is episode 49.
So we can hear even more Pengel. If we were into it, we can hear more of it.
Yeah, you can listen to multiple people who saw that scene and their reactions to it. Man,
all that gel.
Man, this game is weird. Weird and beautiful.
So unlike the other game where we're like, maybe don't play it. If you can track down a copy of Pengel, it would be well worth your time to check it out if you have access to that means to play that. So that'd be really great. I don't think it's a very expensive game either. I think this is actually an affordable one. So get out there and get into it.
Yeah, it is worth seeing. It is a game that's worth seeing, and there are very few games like it, which makes it extra just for your own edification. Give it a shot. Let it into your heart.
That's all for this episode of Hardcore Gaming 101 Top Games Podcast. Special thanks goes out to at GGJofus on Twitter and iBrimley on iTunes for nominating those games. And thanks to those of you we didn't get to yet, we will be getting to you soon. Thanks as well to my lovely co-hosts and special guests, our editor and booking agent, Jeff Rude, our theme song composer, Muteki, our technical assistant, video editor, and scriptwriter, Bobinator, and of course, the support and feedback of listeners like you. You can support this podcast by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101, by subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel, and by following at GC9X and at HG_101 on Twitter. You can also hang out with us on our Discord at bit.ly/HGDiscord. But most importantly, help us claw our way into the podcasting firmament by getting on iTunes, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it, or if we're reincarnated, we'll never be Musashi again! Until next week, keep keeping it real.